Hello, this is episode 6 of Store and Forward, your podcast about the past and future of amateur radio. I'm Kay Savitz, K6KJN. I'm the curator of the Digital Library of Amateur Radio and Communications, a project of the Internet Archive. And I am here with my handsome and smart and wonderful co-host.
I'm Steve Stroh, NAGNJ, and I'm the editor of the Zero Retries newsletter, a newsletter about technological innovation in amateur radio, an independent newsletter about technological innovation in amateur radio, and happy to be here, Kay. And you are handsome as well, and I constantly admire that nearly full head of hair that I don't have, and you know, so I just get rid of it. Too much work to the
thank you
to curate the wisps that I have.
I will allow the listeners of the audio version of this podcast to imagine my full head of hair, and it's striking, I'm sure. I want to talk today about the problem box. So when you send me things to DLARC to be scanned, you have sent many, many boxes. I don't know how many now. A dozen? More?
Oh no, it's well into the 20s.
Well, okay. And you send a nice nice double walled boxes, and you put everything in there very neatly, and there'll be, you know, whatever, 50 of the same issue of, you know, some magazine, not the same issue, but 50 issues of a magazine in order. And then you send a nice spreadsheet, and it makes it all very easy for the people in the scanning centers. And while we appreciate all donations, not all donors are able to be as efficient, as wonderful in their packing and sorting of the information. So when I was in the scanning center, when I visited the scanning center in Fort Wayne, Indiana, a couple weeks ago, I was like, I actually had a couple hours. Like, are there any problems? Anything I can do? Any stuff I can help with? And they're just like, actually, we have some stuff that was donated for DLARC that is complicated, that they keep getting put aside because they're confusing to the scanners. I'm like, okay, great. Because they could put, you know, when they have a box of beautiful, well-organized magazines, they will scan that. And then the confusing box just keeps getting put aside. You know, just like, well, we'll deal with that later. So I dealt with some of it while I was there. And some of it, I didn't have time, so I shipped it to myself. And so I shipped myself the problem box, which I have back here. And it's just this big cardboard box filled with random papers. And the problem is some people have donated things that it might be a wide variety of newsletters or material, and people might be missing pages, or it might not be clear to the casual observer where one issue of the newsletter ends and the next one begins. So it just takes some time for me to sit down and sort through the things. And that's what I've been doing this week, is going through the problem box. I just want to show you some of the things that I've sorted through. For instance, and I'm finding things and, you know, putting paper clips on them so it'll be easier for the scanners, and I put them into a spreadsheet. So we have you know, the Southern California DX Club bulletin from December 1976, and a bunch of other issues of that. We have a paper from AMSAT about the general information about the Oscar 10 satellite, which I think was probably printed when that satellite was launched. And we have like the Washington Coordinator's Report for September 20th, 1984. Just a really wide variety of things. And I get to sort through it and figure out what's important and what goes with what and things. And as I do this, I learn about publications that I didn't know about. A wide variety of thing. For instance, there was something called the W6GO slash K6HHD QSL manager list, and it was some sort of publication for QSL managers. And I've reached out to them, like, hey, I have this one thing about your publication. Do you have more? And so I reach out to them, and hopefully the email doesn't bounce, and hopefully they're still alive. And here's another newsletter called the Diddy Dum Dum Diddy,
Oh,
which,
interesting.
dedicated to the enhancement of amateur radio through information dissemination. This is from February 1971.
Well,
So,
I just to
yeah.
you in our many conversations about my donating stuff to you, I started seeing the issue from your perspective, and so I still have about 20 boxes of loose paper that I have not yet dived through. That not I think I pulled out most of the amateur radio stuff, but I'll still come across an occasional random page that has something interesting to do with amateur radio. And instead of chucking it into the box, I have a separate box of maybe there's more of this that I'll instead of sending it to DLARC as just the single page, because you made the point that it's very tough to categorize and sort and index things, random things. So once I've been through all of those boxes, then I will know. And there, I also have files. It's amazing how many file cabinets you can get for free if you watch Craigslist. So I have acquired file cabinets just for this project, and well, this will be interesting. A bee just flew into my open air shop,
Oh,
and
fun.
yeah, we'll leave that one alone for a while. But you can probably, you're probably getting a little bit of on the camera. So I am trying to not do that to you, what you're describing. I'm trying not to create a problem box for you from my
Thank you. I
contributions.
appreciate that. So, I mean, I appreciate the donations, and people, they need to get rid of the stuff, and it's easier for
Well,
them to put it in a box and send it off. And I'm glad that they do. I don't expect this stuff people send to be perfect, but when it's not, it just has apparent, I didn't know, but it's been sitting in this around the scanning center for a year or more until, I happen to show up. And I have a few more things. I actually haven't, this is the part of the box I have not sorted yet, but I've noticed some interesting things that I will be sorting through and looking through soon. The International Listening Guide for Basic Directory of International Shortwave Broadcasting, published in West Germany in 1986. So that's seems like it's going to be neat. We got a bunch of, I don't even know what these are.
I'm gonna dash
Yeah.
over to my box in progress and show
Okay.
off one of my recent acquisitions.
Okay. Can I keep talking while you do that? Let me do that.
Okay, I'm back.
This box has a bunch of pennants, amateur radio related little flags.
Oh, interesting.
This one says, "Die Stem van Suid-Afrika, the voice of South Africa, Radio
I was
RSA."
guessing that sounded like Afrikaans.
Well, I started reading it. I assumed it was German, but then I like saw South Africa. So,
Yeah, cool.
and then let's see, what's this one? Radio little flag for Radio Baghdad International, and here's another one for Radio Rada CSSR. Anyway, so there's a bunch of those, which. That'll be fun to figure out how to scan those. And then there's also ones from New Zealand, a whole bunch of these envelopes from the this one's from Republic of China. From Taipei, Taiwan, Republic of China, that's what it says. So
Ooh.
from Taiwan. And in it is this newsletter. I think it's a different one that I opened up before. Broadcasting Corporation of China International Service Time and Frequency Schedule. So like a radio schedule from China or Taiwan, and then Republic of China Taiwan newsletter from November 1985. So just a wide variety of things. There's one from Japan that had some sort of Japan newsletter.
I can understand that that the scanning center's job is to scan stuff and just chunk through it, and without the guidance from you
Right.
of the metadata and stuff, that this would be an impossible task for them
Yeah,
because they don't they lack the they
yeah,
don't
they
they
don't want to
lack the
think.
context.
I mean, they don't want to think about it. They just want to scan it, and what I have here is a pile of mail. I mean, it's
Right.
mail which contains various newsletters and things, but they're from all around the world, and Greek radio, television, Radio Australia. I mean, I'm sure this stuff is fascinating, but it just needs to be a needs a little bit of my time to sort through it. So.
Which is exactly your role, in this whole big project. You know, is somebody has to do this, and it's great that the ARDC grant to create DLARC, was able to, give you time to focus on this exact stuff.
Yeah, it
So
is. Yeah.
if this was left as, well, maybe I can get to it one of these days, so Godspeed. And there are millions of amateur radio operators on the planet. And now, and one of the two things that I keep coming back to that is just going to be fantastic for future generations is the ability of an eventual AI, a virtual Elmer, if you will, to be able to take the totality of the information, which is net, once it goes into DLARC, it's digitized, to be able to find the gems and synthesize knowledge from all of that detail. And we now have basically universal translation. So anybody in any country, in any language, can get a translation from any language to any other language. It's not great. There's still an awful lot that's going on in Japan that I would love to be actually reading. And Google Translate doesn't do a fantastic job with Japanese, but I can get the gist. But yeah, in the future, it's just going to get better. So, yeah, I still am just in total awe of what DLARC, that DLARC exists, and I am so glad somebody is doing this, because left to the other, the historical entities in amateur radio wouldn't have gotten done. And thank goodness I'm really, really glad that the Internet Archive stepped up with a grant request to create DLARC. It was a great idea, and you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Godspeed on your work, Kay.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, some of the historical entities are working with us. Like I have mentioned them before, but the California Historical Radio Society. Are you familiar with them?
Is that the folks that are running the shortwave transmitter at Point Reyes, or is this the Queen Mary group?
I don't know. I know they're the home of the Bay Area Radio Museum and Hall of Fame.
I think
So.
this was one of the original AT&T shore stations that was decommissioned. So,
So it sounds like fascinating. Maybe next
oh, it
time I'm down in
is.
the Bay Area.
That's on my list of places to visit on
Yeah,
our
I'd like to.
California trip.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe in October. Anyway, so they have sent me sent DLARC all sorts of material. I've talked about it before, and I'm sure I'll talk about it again. But one of the things that they sent us recently was a publication a few issues of a publication called The Low Band Monitor, which was, let me find it here. It was devoted exclusively to 160 meter, 80 meter, and 40 meter DXing. It was published by a man named Steve Gesiewicz, K0CS, but he wrote it under a pen name, Lance Johnson. And it sounds more like a porn name than, but okay.
You're right. It
Steve slash Lance passed away in 2021 at the age of 73. So this low band
Oh,
monitor.
how cool is that for a ham? Saying 73 at 73.
Even think of that. So this thing was published from April 1993 through at least 2001. I really don't know when that last issue was. Anyway, so I'm gonna, I'm sure I know how to share my screen now. I'm not gonna screw it up this time. So we have 18 issues of this low band monitor. And so it's a nice little newsletter, just about what was happening on 160 meters and whatever. This one's from
I
July
just love
1996.
passion projects like this, because this is a this with a different focus is zero retries, you know, and you know it, this is fantastic stuff. And you know, and I love that the you know the antenna projects that does not age, you know. If you want to do antennas, start diving into the collection.
So anyway, it's a nice little newsletter. I really don't know how many well, I mean, like I said, I know it was published from 91 through, no, what did I say? I'm sorry. Looking at the wrong thing.
Sorry, I don't remember
Through
either.
to the, yeah, it was from 93 to 2001. So I don't know how exactly how many issues there were, but I know that we have a few of them, and I want more. And I can't ask Mr. Johnson for any more because he is silent key. So anyway, if anyone knows anything about the low band monitor, I would really like to fill out that
Well,
collection.
that's a good segue to your most wanted list.
Yes, let's talk about the most wanted list, which I just actually have added to. So the DLARC want list is a web page where I keep a list of the things that that we know we need for Digital Library of Amateur Radio and Communications. And it's at archive.org/details/DLARC-want list. And I just It's just maintain this list, and as we find stuff, it goes off the list. As I find new things I want to add, it goes on the list. And these are things that I know that we need. And the thing is, I learn all the time about new publications or books or whatever that I didn't know about. Maybe very few people knew about. Like I said, I'm going when I go through the problem box, I might find one or two issues of some newsletter that's fascinating. And I try to reach out to the person who published it, see if they're still around, see if they still have copies of it in their basement. Sometimes they're still alive, sometimes they still have copies, and they make them available to me. And sometimes I can't find anything useful. So it goes on the want list. And so I to kind of keep this running list of things that we need to know. And I would ask that any listeners, viewers of this podcast, check out the want list and see if you have anything that we need. And there's 10 times more stuff that we need that we don't know we need that isn't on this list. This is just stuff that we know are gaps in the collection. They're like, yeah, known, I should call this the known gaps in the collection. There's plenty of unknown gaps in the collection. One of the known gaps in the collection. As I was going through the Bob Cooper stuff, he did all sorts of publications. He was so prolific. He did a bunch of magazines, a bunch of TV shows. I don't know how he found the time and the energy. One of the things that he published was Koop's Technology Digest, which he called a confidential industry newsletter, published 10 times a year. It was published from 1991 through 2002. So that's what, 11 years?
Wow.
And 91 issues were published altogether. And this was communications and technology news. He was living in New Zealand at the time, so a lot of it is New Zealand specific stuff, and but not all of it. And here, this in this one particular issue from 2001, some of the topics are Australian broadcasters join hands, sport anti-siphoning rules under attack. I don't know what that means. BBC to help fund digital transition. Tele Saturn's DVB-S launch problems. And we have this other issue. Oops, that's I have another issue from 95, and stuff about encryption and satellite launches and MTV Mandarin misuses Madonna. I don't even know. So just tech news. Communication news that was happening contemporarily reported, and real fascinating stuff. So he published this thing, and these 91 issues were published, and we have most of them. We're missing 19 issues, and
From the
from
Coop archives?
from the
Wow.
Coop from the Coop archive. Now who knows? Like one of the gaps is like issues 57 to 74 are missing. So I imagine that they were together in a binder, in order, and either that binder didn't make it to the storage unit, or somebody pulled it out, or who knows. But that was kind of frustrating, like the whole this gap that was probably together. And then like issue 80, issue 85, so just here and there ones are missing. But
Ooh,
we
maybe
have
that was forbidden knowledge.
maybe. Right. Anyway, so I'm looking. Those issues are on the want list. These particular issues of Koop's Technology Digest, because I would really like to make this a complete collection.
Sure, absolutely.
So the first thing I did was I looked in. What's it called? I can't think of what it's called right now. Went to my library's interlibrary loan section where you can search libraries all over the world and see what they have. And I searched for Koop's Technology Digest. Two libraries in the world have a collection of this digest. And I thought,
Whoa.
maybe they can fill in. Both of these libraries are in New Zealand because that's where it was published. I should have mentioned that this publication did not have a very large subscriber base. At one point, I found a note or something that said there were about 150 subscribers. So there's not a million of these out there in the world. Anyway, so I have reached out to the library in New Zealand and explained who I am and what we're doing, and like, can they scan these issues that we're missing? I haven't heard back from them yet. It's been a few days, so I don't know if that's going to work out, but. Anyway, so I'm trying to fill in the gaps, and I would love to have a complete collection of Koop's Technology Digest. If you have any, please let me know.
So speaking of things we didn't know we wanted, is that we have a number of really good bookstores here in Bellingham, Washington area. And one of them, my favorite, is called Eclipse Bookstore, and it's a entirely used bookstore, and you literally have to wade between the stacks of books on the floor, on both levels of the bookstore. And he does do a great job of curating the techie stuff into one particular section. So when I go visit, I just go downstairs into the basement and go to the techie section. And I was browsing and I found this. Oh boy. Yeah, crap. There. Come on.
Your Zoom background
Yeah.
is blurring it out.
Oh, I got to
Is
put it right up. So
what's it say?
it's called,
D.
it's a book called De-Expeditioning. Now, I would not have imagined that there is a large enough market to publish a book on how to do a de-expedition. This is, basically tribal knowledge kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
And for those who don't know, de-expedition is where you take a whole bunch of radio gear and a whole bunch of people, and you go to some very obscure part, which is administratively considered to be a country, an independent country. And then you set up, and lots of people try to contact you and work the contact, and you get to add another country into your list of countries worked. The book is subtitled De-Expeditioning Behind the Scenes, et cetera. I didn't know that this book existed, didn't know that this book would exist. So there was no price on it. It's used, published, I don't remember when. April 2000. I explained to the owner, said, this is worth, I think I said, $20 to me, and I'm going to turn around and donate it to the Internet Archive. And he says, $20 is the right price. And so, I did love to support independent bookstores, so I didn't try to lowball him. So anyway, so this is in my box of DLark stuff, which is about half full, and as soon as it preaches full, I will send that off,
Beautiful.
get
That's
another, 30, 40 pounds of paper out of my shop. If
excellent.
it didn't have a cement foundation, it would start to be rising.
We do have the De-Expeditions collection in DLark, which is a bunch of mostly audio tapes of people describing de-expeditions that they have done, going back to the 1960s. And it's just fascinating to hear people tell the story about, what it took to get all of that radio equipment and generators and whatever to Bangladesh or to Marion Island or to, Jarvis Island or wherever.
For
It seems,
there's
seem, I mean, see, I mean, I'm glad people enjoy it, but it seems like de-expeditions combine like the worst of travel with the worst of radio problems. Just like
Well, I did a story a while ago about one of the problems with the expeditions is that some of the places that you want to go are ecologically sensitive, or they're just inhospitable. Like some little islets are, the dominant life form on the island is stone crabs because they basically are invulnerable to just about anything but man. And they own the island. So if you try to set yourself up on that island, you are in for a world of hurt because you can't hurt them because, they're a sensitive species. So they came up with the interesting idea of the de-expedition in a box. So they built a big container with HF radios and all the electronics for to do a de-expedition. And then they put a liquid cooling system into it. And the idea is that you drop, you make a brief landing, you set up this equipment, which is all hardened against the stone crabs and other creatures. And I don't know if it's a generator or batteries or solar panels or whatever, just power source, radio. And then there's a radio link, a broadband radio link back to the boat. And the boat hangs out offshore. So you've all the head end of the radios, the panels are coming, is being remoted via the radio link, and you're sitting on the boat with a full kitchen, toilets, fresh water, fans,
Couple of
probably
beers.
air conditioning, the whole bit. And that's the proper way to do a de-expedition.
Nice.
And the radio is on the land, which is the administrative entity. So that just I don't personally, want to be a DXer, but I do appreciate their, the innovative technology that they put to work, doing it, so, that part zero retry's interesting.
Nice.
So, I just I and again I my input into, the why DLark matters, you know, the dusty history of amateur radio is that the past informs the present. And, you know, we, you know, there's so many good ideas that we have had and, you know, that are do well documented, lovingly documented. And one of my many, many projects is to dive deep into the DLARC archives, especially the TAPR and the Digital Communications Conference's data, you know, the information, and to really do a good job of mining that information for future. Like one example is we actually orbited a type of satellite called a PacSat, packet satellite. It had four independent receivers, it had one high-speed transmitter, and it was basically a flying bulletin board system. So it would fly over one part of the world, you would upload your traffic, it would transit in orbit, and then download that BBS message to a, you know, to the user. And you would periodic, you know, you knew you have the schedule, the orbit, and you say, okay, anything for NAGNJ? Yes, we do. And then it comes down, you know, on one high-speed channel. And it's a beautiful integration of uploading on a low performance, but very easy to use radio transmitter, like 1200 baud, and then downloading from a higher speed modem, which is receive is easy, transmitting is hard. And so, especially now that we've got these, you know, fantastic software-defined receivers that are cheap, now we can do this stuff, you know, easy. And you could actually do this on, you know, instead of doing a conventional repeater, especially a data repeater, you could now do a pack, you could put a pack set on a mountain or a tower. And you know, this stuff is easy to do now we've got with current technology. It was hard to do back then. It required dedicated hardware, you know, one of a kind stuff that went on a satellite. Now we can it's software and parts. So that's, sorry, I could, as you well know, I could just go drone on and on about this stuff. So, but though for the future of amateur radio part, I wanted to of this episode, I wanted to do a brief excursion into M17, which is another, has become a passion project of Zero Retries. And M17 is a started from scratch digital voice system for amateur radio, VHF and UHF bands. And the critical things are it's open source. It was a very well developed spec from a lot of people. And it's specifically for amateur radio and specifically for VHF, UHF. So, i.e., a fairly wide channel of 15 to 20 kilohertz and quiet, relatively low noise compared to HF, for example. I've done several deep dives on M17. And the critical thing that a lot of people in amateur radio miss is that the fact that it's open source. And most people say, oh, that's nice. You know, good to know. You know, open source, good, you know, moving on. But there are an awful lot of people in amateur radio that are really rabid, hardcore, very passionate about open source technologies and amateur radio to the and they won't use anything but open source technologies and amateur radio. So finally, digital voice systems in amateur radio are now interesting to them solely because M17 exists. And that is a big deal because the folks that are the newer folks that are coming into amateur radio are techies. They're young, they trend younger. They are very comfortable with software, and M17 is almost entirely a software system with hardware to support it. In fact, it can be implemented entirely on in software with an internet connectivity. So M17 is a big deal for those folks, and they are the critical new element that makes amateur, you know, amateur radio have a future. So unfortunately, the powers that be don't quite get it. You know, the ones that actually own the repeaters, with a very few exceptions. There's a Mount Diablo amateur radio, Mount Diablo repeater. So I don't, I wish I should have dug that out. They sponsor a digital voice repeater in California, and they recently added M17 to the mix, and it works fine. So the
Mount
theme that I'm
Diablo Amateur Radio Club. They're in DLARC, so like, yeah, I'm familiar with them.
right.
Yeah, founded
So
in
they are very,
1947.
very progress, almost to the point where I want to join the group, even though I'm nowhere near in their coverage area, you know, because that's the progressive kind of club that I really want to support. I wish we had one like that in Seattle. We don't. My train of thought jumped a track.
Sorry, my fault.
No, it's okay. The repeater owners don't, the current repeater owners don't get it. They don't understand why we need yet another digital voice system to add to the three that we already have, which is DMR, D-Star, and System Fusion, all of which use a proprietary coder decoder, which, you know, null and void for the open source folks. You know, it's like, yeah, full stop. No, thank you. But the M17, let's talk. So there is a technology called MMDVM, multi-mode digital voice modem, that was specifically, and this was a revelation for me in Zero Retries, was specifically designed to for amateur radio repeaters to support those digital voice, all of those digital voice modes. And you didn't have to buy the repeater from Choose One, Yaesu. You didn't have to buy it from Icom. You didn't have to buy it from Motorola. You could just refit an old FM repeater with the MMDVM, and then you can support digital voice modes. And one of the modes that was added into the mix was M17. So if you put MMDVM into your repeater, you can support M17. And another revelation in Zero Retries was that we've got all the pieces in place to be using M17. And now, just recently, there's a company called Connect Systems, which now makes a out-of-the-box M17 portable radio called the CS7000 M17. And that is the very first, you know, out of the box, straight from the factory M17 radio. Everything else has been a bit of a science experiment, or a project. Now, but we M17 is now ready to go. People are putting these things on the air. They're buying radios. They're buying the CS7000 M17s. And then here's an interesting bit about why it really matters. So one of the new experimental things that the developer of M17 just recently did as a proof of concept is he put public key, private key authentication into
Wow.
M17.
Nice.
So if you have a, if there's a public key, private key, you can sign your transmissions with the public, with your private key, and you can verify with the public key that those are, those transmissions are actually coming from you.
So it's not encrypted, which wouldn't be allowed, but it is, it does use like the public key part of it to sign things.
Right. It's, you can authenticate that the person transmitting this, the person that that transmission came from who it was claimed. You can't spoof, you know, even if you tried to spoof the call sign, it wouldn't do you any good. Another thing about M17 is that data and voice are co-equal. You can treat it like a data modem if you want and send just, you know, random data through it, including files. And best of all, returning to the theme that we talked about in our previous episode, messaging. I really think that messaging is going to become a big deal in amateur radio, data messaging, short messaging, SMS, texting, et cetera, because it's something that the younger generations really care about. And especially now that we've had the fantastic example of Meshtastic, which is an open source project using an app on your phone and license exempt portions of spectrum like 902 to 928. So amateur radio can do every bit as good and much better. We just haven't tried. And so M17 being able to, the creator of M17 created a quick and dirty app to be able to do messaging through M17. So if we put M17 repeaters on the air, we can be doing all this stuff. We can be doing data and digital voice and messaging. We have all these capabilities now, and we just need to really start making use of them and showing them off. And that's what's going to keep amateur radio vital, in this decade and beyond. Because, if you just read the amateur radio publishing industrial complex publications and their perspective, it's like, amateur radio, old, tired, grandpa in the basement, tapping on a Morse code key, and it's not. It's way, way better than that. I feel like zero retries is like I'm watching this stream of innovation go by, and I'm reaching in with both hands and pulling a little bit out, typing, and then watching more of it go by, and it says, "Now I reach in."
You got your fishing net, you're going to catch so much of it,
Catch
right?
so much, exactly. So, in my wildest fantasies, I would become, a modern day Wayne Green with a staff and a budget, and advertisers and all that stuff, and then I can, at least do it an attempt of, reasonable coverage. So anyway.
I would love that as long as you keep your feet on the ground, which Wayne Green didn't always
It's
do.
true. Well, let's not go. Although I am absolutely, again, yet another plug for DLARC that, thank you for putting the entire collection of 73 magazine online in DLARC, because unlike certain other groups,
I don't know what you're talking about. No idea.
complete there's a there's you know the complete run of 73 magazines is publicly available. It's digitized, all of it's there, and you can search it and find it, and anybody in the world can grab it. All that knowledge is there, unlike other publications. So
There are some other publications, but yes, not all. I mean, monitoring times, as said, we can put everything online. That's a fun magazine for shortwave listening that went out of business in 2013. We don't have every issue, actually. We're missing a bunch, but we have permission. So if they show up, those are also in the DLARC want list. So, but yeah, 70, Wayne Green was very forward thinking in doing that, and we love that about him.
That's all I had for this episode was just, I knew I was gonna dish on M17, so I just decided to
Great.
stay with the one topic.
Appreciate it. All right. Well, I guess we'll wrap it up and I'll get back to my problem box, which isn't getting any emptier. This has been Store and Forward, your podcast about the past and future of amateur radio. I am K Savitz, K6KJN. If you would like to add to my problem box, please contact me at k@archive.org to find out how to make your donation of items to the Digital Library of Amateur Radio and Communication so that they will be available for the world to enjoy online for free.
And I am Steve Stroh, NHGNJ, and I am the editor of the Zero Retries newsletter, a newsletter about technological innovation in amateur radio. And you can find Zero Retries at www.zeroretries, RETRIES.org. And subscriptions are free. And join 2,000 plus of us that read my latest brain drivelings every week on Friday at 15:30 Pacific. Well, thanks again, Kay. This is always fun. Sometimes a little too much fun. We can go down some real rabbit holes. 7-3, buddy.
73.